I'd like to call to order the February 21st Ways and Means Committee hearing. Mr. Smith will note the roll. The next item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the February 3rd meeting. Would somebody like to move those minutes? Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. The next item on our agenda is House File 103. Representative Murray, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 103 for consideration by the committee, and then I believe you also have an amendment, the 49 amendment.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And if you'd explain to the committee why you need to put the 49 amendment on.
One moment, Representative. Let's head out.
So working? Okay. Good morning. I'm Rich Murray. I'm a rep in Freeborn County, Maurer County, and I'm here today with House File 103, and I have an author's amendment. The author's amendment, I need to put a sunset provision on what we're doing here today. On the amendment, what we'll do is on line 1.2, page 2, line 9, after the period insert, this section expires when federal law no longer allows a three-year look-back period. So I'd just like the members to approve this amendment to get my bill in good order. Thank you.
All right. Members, are there any questions on the 49 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Murray, if you want to explain your bill to the committee.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 103 has two parts to it, and it revolves around unemployment insurance. The first part of the bill is regarding family-owned businesses, and what we're going to do here is we want to restore the opportunity for adult children of business owners to receive unemployment benefits to the same extent as any other employee. Under a change that was enacted last year, employees of family-owned businesses who are the owner's children are limited to receiving a maximum of 5 weeks of state unemployment benefits. Previously, the limitation had only applied to the owner's spouse, parent, or minor children. This change is made by reinstating the word minor on line 1.10. The estimated cost of this provision to the unemployment trust fund is estimated to be between 1.5 and 2 million a year and will affect between 3 and 500 families. These are generally small family-owned businesses that will be affected, and this will be a retroactive amendment to July 1st of 2010, and the Department of Employment and Economic Development does support this change in the language. The second part of the bill is to address the federal extended benefits that were approved by the federal government in December of 2010. This change allows unemployed Minnesotans to receive federal extended unemployment benefits once their state and other federal benefits are exhausted. Congress voted in December 2010 to extend the time frame that benefits are available until the end of this year. The latest extension provides up to 13 weeks of extended benefits. These benefits are funded 100% by the federal government. The extension does not increase the state's UI trust fund deficit. Under current law, our benefits in this state, the extended benefits, will cease the middle of March because the state unemployment rate, though high, hasn't increased fast enough to qualify for the federal extension. House File 103 would change the qualifying threshold. Currently, we have a two-year look-back, and in order to get the extension, our two-year look-back, we have to have a 10% increase in the unemployment rate in the state of Minnesota. House File 103 would change the qualifying threshold under the so that we have a three-year look-back instead of the current two-year look-back. This change is allowed under the federal law in recognition that the recession has been deep and protracted. This would allow 55,000 unemployed Minnesotans to collect unemployment benefits between the middle of March and December, the end of December of 2011. The estimated cost or benefit that will come into the state of Minnesota is $160 million, and as I said again, this is fully funded by the federal government. I will now take any questions that anybody would have.
Thank you. Members, any questions for Representative Murray? Wow. Think you're gonna. All right. Well, if there are no questions for the bill author, then I would renew my motion that House File 103, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion's adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Commissioner, if you'd care to join us. And members, in your packet is about the first three or four pages of the commissioner's presentation, so we'll see if he gets ahead of us here, but as soon as they got copies ready, they'll distribute the whole presentation to the committee members. Welcome to the committee. Do you need some help with the computer? Or?
Undoubtedly. Let's see. Thank you. Got the screen up now. That's what I wanted. While we figure that out, Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Jim Showalter, for the record, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, here to give you an overview on the Governor's budget recommendations for 2012 and 13.
Thank you, members. And I think what we'd like to do is let him get through his presentation and hold questions till the end. So, Commissioner?
Great. Madam Chair, members, I believe you have a set of slides in your folders that I will walk through. If I get out of order at any point, just let me know. Otherwise, I think we should all be in sync, even without the overheads.
Well, Ms. Commissioner, they're actually, right now, they only have about the first three pages because of a printing error, and so without the overhead and lack of a complete packet of handouts, we probably would be going pretty blind here, so.
We will keep working on that, I guess.
Okay.
I could turn the laptop around, but I don't think that's going to cut it.
Probably not. I think we're having a good Monday morning meeting so far.
Madam Chair, as I said, it's the dedication is good.
Yeah.
But everything seems to be working against us this morning. Speaking of working against us, Commissioner Jessen, unfortunately, was planning on being here but had a death in the family, so will not be here. She does have staff to help answer questions. Commissioner Casilius was also planning on being here. She was out in greater Minnesota and is currently snowed in at the moment, so I will try to do what I can for you. We'll just hone in on the first couple of slides that you have printed out. We'll just stay there.
Thank you.
The governor's budget recommendation is, as you all know, a statement of priorities and is really the result of an extended set of discussions and review of agency budgets, options, and, frankly, a pretty involved decision-making process. We started in a little later than normal, simply because of the recount. So by the time we started going, it was in January, and the governor really focused in on what were the questions, what were the issues and the problems that he's trying to resolve with his biennial budget request. The obvious one is finding $6.2 billion to make sure that the state's budget is balanced. We have no choice about that. That is really a minimum goal. However, beyond that, he was looking for ways to make sure that the impact of the budget changes were equitable and certainly did not come disproportionately on lower and middle income groups. He was looking for some way to make sure that we had a strategy that kept some of the economic vitality in the state going forward and made a structural change so that not only were we balancing the current year budget, but as you all know, the budget is out of balance for on a structural basis for years to come. The question of why do we have a $6.2 billion budget hole is one that I think everyone's familiar with, but I'll touch on real briefly. You know, the recession that the state and the nation have gone through the last couple of years has had a significant impact on jobs, incomes in the state, and ultimately tax revenues of the state. We're collecting about the same level of revenues in 2012 and 13 as we did in 2008 and 9. Means that sort of revenue growth that normally would occur over a four-year period is permanently gone. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean that some of the spending pressure is left as well. Healthcare inflation on an annual basis, even in the recession, ran around 8% a year. We have more demand for some of our programs because of the economic problems. We have about 11,000 more families with kids in our medical assistance program, about 20,000 more elderly and disabled in our medical assistance program since 2008 and 2009. So the question is, you know, well, why don't we just keep everything flat, go back to 2008 and 2009 spending levels? The big point is healthcare costs are substantially above what they were in 2008 and 2009, so we have to find some way to deal with that. As you're getting the slides, thank you very much, Harry. I am about to roll into slide number 3.
Thank you, Mom.
Which just shows you, in very simple terms, the beginning balance based upon the November forecast, changes in revenues and expenditures, and the ending balance. As you'll see, there are significant changes in revenues, an increase of about 12.7% from the forecast level, significant decrease in the expenditures of about 5% reduction from the forecast level. And overall, you know, I think you have a pretty straightforward view on this in the next couple of slides. There are no new shifts associated with that. There's not a bevy of different fees or other kinds of revenue raisers in this budget. Really, you have a pretty straightforward presentation here of new revenues and reduced expenditures, almost all of which are on a permanent basis. The components of the governor's budget solution on slide 4, you'll see some of the major elements. On a net basis, expected reductions are about $485 million. There are about $950 million of permanent recommendation reductions included in the governor's recs. However, there are some new expenditures. About half of those are associated with one of the revenue items, that is the Medicaid surcharge. We can go into that more if you'd like. Increased resources, about $4.1 billion. Much of that, about a little over half of that, is in permanent tax increases. There is an temporary income surtax, about 3% on the upper income brackets, and along with health care surcharges, that's known as the Medicaid surcharges that have been done before. Certainly this is an expansion of those and within the Medicaid program. Ultimately, you'll see here there's about $14 million of efficiencies, and mostly related to tax conformity, before you get to a balance of around $3 million for 2012 and 13. Overall, the components, the process, as you know, is you start with sort of where you expect to go. And I think, at least anecdotally, I heard some people when the governor's budget was really saying, well, really, you know, I was expecting such and such a percentage of cuts, this percentage of revenues, you know, and how do you get there? And I think it's important to underscore the iterative process, to understand where you want to start, and then you take an assessment of what really some of the impacts are from some of those budget reductions or tax increases, and what your options really are. To put it into context, in 2004 and 5, when Governor Plenty issued his first budget after the transition, we had a $4.2 billion deficit, known as a monstrous, a mind-bendingly large deficit at the time. That was made up of about $2 billion in spending reductions and about $2.2 billion in revenues, shifts, or other sources. Looking ahead, on the next slide, I can show you the proposed general fund expenditures. As you would expect, those are really focused on some of the priorities that the governor stated prior to being elected, as well as after the election. K-12 education not only was held harmless, but there were some small increases, so that spending increased for each year of the biennium. Those increases were really focused on children, on early education programs, as well as initiatives to make sure that we can foster an environment of achievement in K-12 schools. Higher education was reduced by $171 million. Local aids and credits was also held harmless, so that the level that you have in the forecast is what is, in fact, recommended by the governor's budget. Health and human services reductions, about $680 million. A number of difficult choices in that area, but it also being the area where expenditures on a biennium to biennium basis continue to grow, it is really quite critical to try and continue to slow down that area. For context, I also want to note that Health and Human Services is in a very interesting spot if you look at it historically, with federal health reform really taking into account a lot of changes and a lot of new opportunities in 2014-15. We're still a couple years short of that. How does the state position itself for federal health care reform? What is its approach to that? And how do you make sure that the impacts of the transition are felt or minimized for families throughout the state? Those are some of the real difficult questions that Commissioner Jessen tried to tackle in this budget recommendation. I should note also one of the themes, we'll come back to that in a second. General fund expenditure growth on the next slide, just at the highest level. At the time of the forecast, there was a lot of discussion of, well, 27.5% growth in spending. That seems like a very, very large percentage growth for the forecast. I think everyone here already is well aware of what drove that. It goes back, in fact, to the end of session numbers. It goes back even to you know, Governor Plenty's last budget. Was we knew that there were one-time resources that were going to be proposed to help us solve the 10 and 11 budget. The federal stimulus funds, most notably, about $2.3 billion were received in 2010 and 11. In addition, the K-12 spending shift resulted in about $1.9 billion in one-time savings. Well, one time really is one time, unfortunately. And so while the state still ended up having a programming level and essentially kept the expectation that those resources and those programs are going to continue into 12 and 13, and we didn't have to pay for it in the same way, or didn't build it into the expenditure side in the same way that we normally would. The result is a very, very large percentage buy-in to buy-in increase between those two. After you back out those factors, after you back out those one-time resources, you'll see that the governor's recommendation level is about 7.5% biennium to biennium in changes in expenditures from 10 and 11 to 12 and 13. What you get for that, there is certainly changes in the populations being served. You see about 35,000 more people, that is parents and children, in medical assistance. You see another 11,000 more elderly and disabled Minnesotans also in the medical assistance program, biennium to biennium, all built within that 7.5% increase. About 15,000 more students in the K-12 program are also funded through the forecast adjustment. Next slide looks at the general fund revenue proposals. As anticipated, the governor included a fourth-tier income tax increase, taking it up to 10.95%, increases revenues by about $1.9 billion. Beyond that, there are a number of other proposals, including a temporary surtax on incomes over $500,000, worth about $900 million. The health care surcharges are a notable one of around $877 million overall, as well as some closing some corporate and other loopholes worth about $430 million. Overall, about $4.1 billion revenue increase. The tax proposal really is fashioned to protect middle-class households. The income tax proposals in particular are fashioned so that only about 5% of the Minnesotans will see any income tax increase. About 95% will not. The overall impact of this also on state and local taxes, we're still doing the detailed calculations. There's something called the price of government that I think many of you are familiar with. It's been in law for quite a number of years. It takes into account the revenues that are anticipated to be raised from local property taxes, as well as statewide taxes like the income tax and other corporate taxes. Right now, we're anticipating that the price of government, in rough terms, should be around 16.2%, which is about the same as it was in 2006. It is higher than it was last year, but it is certainly still within the realm of some of the recent years. Overall, the next slide, it looks at the structural balance. You'll see under the November forecast, we had a structural deficit of about $2.7 billion in 2014, another $2.3 billion in 2015, around $5.1 billion anticipated shortfall over the biennium. Under the governor's recommendations, that decreases to $672 million in the first year, $465 in the second year, roughly $1.1 billion. I should note that the surtax is phased out so that none of that impact is included in the 2015 numbers. Stepping back, I mentioned, you'll see the next slide is just really one of those pie graphs that you're all familiar with. Most of the pie graphs don't really move too much year to year, but comment I made before about really sort of a one area that continues to grow, it really does start to impact this pie graph. You'll see Health and Human Services at about 32.3% of the general fund expenditures, which is a relatively large amount. Usually it used to be in the around 28% thereabouts. Overall, for budget balancing purposes, you'll see again that four areas dominate the general fund discussion, K-12 education being about 38%. Health and Human Services, 32%, and local property tax aids and credits, about 9%, higher ed, another 7%. So really, once you've gone through those four areas, there's roughly only about 10% left on the table for a discussion for public safety, transportation, economic development, all these other areas. All sources is another perspective that I think is very useful and very important for the Ways and Means Committee to have. In all funds, you're seeing a total state and federal budget of about $6.63 billion. A little over half of that is the general fund recommendations that I've been detailing so far. We'll go into more detail in a second. Beyond that, there's another little more than 27% is federal funds. So the state does significant amount of work for the federal government. Some of that is Medicaid dollars flowing through. Some of that is specific programs in the health department, in transportation, in agriculture, public safety. So it's a significant additional part of the overall state operations. As we see cutbacks coming from Congress, I would expect that you will see continued pressure on that part of the budget as well. The state has a general policy of not trying to fill in some of those federal funds, but obviously there's always a discussion that has to happen, both at the executive branch and the legislative branch, as some of those projects and programs are trimmed back. Other funds that you see here, Trunk Highway Fund, Debt Service Fund, other special revenue funds, make up the rest balance of the overall state expenditures. As you look at those dollars, you should also note that from a state employment perspective, roughly 30% of the state employees are funded out of the general fund. The remaining number of employees are largely in the other funds. You'll see that some of the more employee-intensive areas, such as some of the transportation programs, vets' homes, other things like that, tend to be operated outside of the general fund, and that's where some of those employee numbers would come from as well. We briefly saw a flicker on the screen. That was
for, me also.
For us both. But instead, I'll continue on with my narrative. I should have brought Garrison Keillor along to prepare because his voice is much more interesting than mine. The next slide. We're going to go into the next section is just detailing in a little bit more specificity some of the major areas and recommendations of the governor's budget. First one is local aids, credits, property tax relief, about $3.5 billion in the general fund. The governor, I think, said pretty clearly he's making no reductions to local government aid programs in his recommendations. Part of that is the logic of the impact on local aids and local units of government. When LGA is reduced, when county program aids are reduced, historically we have seen that property taxes come under pressure and that there's increases. He wanted to make sure that the property tax, which is the regressive tax, really does not increase. He also made sure that he protected some of the property tax refund programs for homeowners and renters, which tend to be more progressive in nature as well. He He also, on the next slide, in K-12 education finance, worth about $14.2 billion in the general fund, prioritized education programs. I made sure that school payments were continued through 12 and 13 with small increases. The buyback of the aid payment shift, which was in the forecast, is delayed out of this biennium into the next biennium, at which point in 2014, if the forecast trigger isn't already invoked, would basically start on a payment plan of 10% a year so that we are not, so that at least at the worst case scenario is we had built it into our expected expenditures over the next decade. Commissioner Casilius, if she were here, would talk about some of the key investments in greater detail. That includes optional all-day kindergarten program and early childhood rating program, trying to make sure that the early learners really get a early start that we have seen a lot of research around that area. And it is one of the strategies that she's trying to pursue and the governor is trying to pursue to make sure that kids are ready, particularly lower income kids, that they're ready when they hit kindergarten. Other areas that are really critical include rewarding achievement and innovation. We just know that, you know, even with stable funding, that doesn't mean that education per se gets better. So one of the key focuses is how to disseminate best practices, highlight high-achieving schools, highlight strategies that for principals as well as for teachers, highlight those strategies that work, because ultimately that is what is most important, is what's going on in the school, the management of the schools, and trying to make sure that we highlight some of those impacts. Healthcare reform on the next page. In the context of federal healthcare reform coming quite soon, something called the health exchange is going to be coming. And how do we get that going? We, in just a short period of time, will need to find ways to have that marketplace mechanism in place. And so we will be seeking federal funds to help that process, both as $1 million initial funding as well as more operational funding from the federal government. The end point should be that we have developed a streamlined eligibility determination system for public programs and found mechanisms that will allow people to really access private insurance more easily. We're going to continue looking at healthcare reform broadly as well. The governor includes a recommendation of $40 million from the Healthcare Access Fund for SHIP, which is really a statewide health improvement program that's looking at public health strategies to dovetail with enrollment and eligibility standards. Also, looking for ways to make sure that the system itself just becomes more efficient, and that includes electronic health record technology. Ultimately, on the next slide, you're to see that Commissioner Jessen and the governor focused the reductions in an attempt to make sure that the impacts of those reductions are not impacting those with the lowest income. That we're going to continue coverage for all children and adults with incomes below 200% of poverty line. We are, however, recommending within this set of recommendations at least a reduction of a Minnesota coverage to the 200% line. That is consistent with where the federal standard is expected to be, but it's certainly a difficult reduction. It's a difficult set of choices that we'll all have to continue looking at. Also looking to manage long-term care programs with those with the greatest needs, are limiting some of the growth in the waiver programs, as you know. It's a very expensive program, but it is also those with some of the highest needs, needs for assisted daily living services, and as a result, we're trying to limit the growth in some of those programs. The next page outlines additional proposals that are included in the Health and Human Services recommendations. Ultimately, I think it's critical to say that the strategy of reducing some of the provider rates, protecting services to vulnerable adults, is still not going to be an easy path. That there are going to be quite a few questions that are going to come up in Representative Abler's committee about how we accomplish that, and I think that's a fair discussion. We also tried to raise revenues through the Medicaid program and the Medicaid surcharge, totaling about $627 million. ultimately, I think there's the course here was trying to preserve as much access as possible. In the higher education funding area, about $2.7 billion, you'll see quite a few recommendations, including in the state grant program, protecting that from reductions, along with about a 6% reduction both from the major education systems of MinSCU and the University of Minnesota. Both have stated they believe they can manage this level of reductions within the tuition increase levels that they've already announced. We will be trying to work with them in that area. In public safety, an area that is one of the largest of the remaining general fund areas outside of the big four. In the courts area, we've heard a lot about declining access, inability of the court system to hear things in an expedited manner. And so the governor's recommendations hold, do not reduce the court system, and provide, as the Chief Justice requested, modest increases related to insurance increases for that area. At the correctional institutions, the unspecified reduction in the base was basically restored and then started cutting from there to make specified reductions in the prison programs in public corrections areas. The net result is about $26 million. Throughout this recommendation, you see a lot of numbers. You see a lot of specific proposals, and you tend to go to the high level of, well, what's the numbers? I just want to say that underneath this has been a lot of discussions about trying to provide value for taxpayers. That, you know, in the end, with the reductions, whether they should be higher or lower, it's how do you make sure these programs operate effectively and get managers focused on some kinds of results. There are a couple of specific budget recommendations at this point. We'll continue to be working on some additional ones. Even within the recommendations, we have about $250,000 a year for a results-oriented manager structure. Basically, the chief of staff will be convening the commissioners of management and budget, administration, and enterprise technology, trying to, in a couple of different ways, expedite high-priority projects so that when we say we want to get something done, we really focus our attention and some of the administrative hurdles that have to occur so that we get them done, and we get them done well, and we get the results that we had initially been promised or promised the legislature. Beyond that, we want to make sure that agencies have clear and articulated performance goals. That's just some of the work that we're trying to get done. Commissioner Jessen could also talk quite extensively about some of the reforms in buying and purchasing health care that she's undertaking in the Department of Human Services. Multi-billion-dollar enterprise, yet I think some of the competitive bidding process that we hope to be working through very shortly should get taxpayers more value for their dollars. In the end, there's been a lot of discussion about state employees and the impacts of various proposals. I do want to note that within the general fund, about a 6% reduction of the state employee workforce is the estimated impact from the reductions and from the changes that are included here based on increases in insurance costs as well as the operating reductions that you see in a number of different agencies. The investments and in reductions reflect priorities. You will see in the military vets affairs, again, generally held them harmless along with some of the promises from previous years are carried out, including a 21-bed specialty care unit in Fergus Falls Vets Home and an adult daycare center in Minneapolis Vets Home. Otherwise, you'll see a range of reductions depending on the budget area throughout the area. In terms of revenue increases, the notion here was really to try and raise revenues fairly and responsibly. I've talked about many of the recommendations, including the fourth tier, the three-year surtax on filers over 500K. There's also a statewide property tax on homes valued over $1 million. There are some limited tax conformity recommendations as well for fiscal year 11. If you were to have the entire chart or on the screen, you would also see just some sample household sizes with the different scenarios of incomes, household values, and the impact of this tax proposal on those. you would see that in many, and if not most instances, you would see no impact on those households. About 95% of the defilers will see no tax increases. In the corporate area and other areas, you'll see a reduction or a repealing of the corporate foreign royalty subtraction and the FOC provision. Closing of the snowbird loophole so that part-year residents of the state will pay at least a part of their revenues to the state, and other changes. In the end, the budget is really a comprehensive proposal to try and find a way to deal with what is a really large, large challenge that's facing Minnesota right now, about $6.2 billion in deficit. All of the detailed recommendations are included in documents that are on our website. Those budget books have been prepared so that you have detailed fiscal analysis as well as just general descriptions of the programs that the state operates, and change pages so that you can see each and every one of the recommendations that the governor is making. Due to the timeline, we are going to be doing a February forecast very, very soon. On the 28th, that will be released. After that, the governor will reprice his recommendations, so that will take a few days at least, so that some of the areas in K-12 and the services in particular will get adjusted. Depending on the outcome of the forecast, the governor may or will make, at least decide what kind of modifications he may want to make out of the recommendations, and we will reissue all of that material at that point in time. Agencies are also available to start walking through those specific recommendations, and that pretty much concludes my presentation. What you have before you is the PowerPoint slides that were used at the governor's press conference. There are also available one-pagers on some of the major areas of his recommendations, as well as roughly 3,500 pages of detailed budget documents that are available for committee use throughout the rest of the session. So with that, Madam Chair, I stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I was just looking at the section on the talking about the shared services model for operational support for the smallest agencies and whatnot. Does that mean that the governor supports the shared services model for our school districts and maybe our counties and our cities as well?
Commissioner Schuyler.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't want to make that leap because I know there's a number of assumptions in that, and I'm not sure of his specific stance on shared services for school districts. I do know that finding strategies to reduce back office operations is something that he supports. Certainly finding ways in this particular instance for agencies that have a role but have difficulty carrying them out because they don't have the ability to work within the state system very effectively is the specific proposal that's before you. You've probably heard in previous years about the SMART initiative operated out of the Department of Administration. Really is there to make sure that some of those small agencies do what they do best, and that the budgeting, the HR functions, the financial functions are handled competently so that they don't get themselves into trouble. That's what the proposal in the budget itself is about.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I'd be curious to get a little more details on what he's thinking there, because I know there's been several lawmakers that have proposed having shared services school districts and also on our counties and city levels, and given the financial package that he has here regarding local government aid, it'd be just intriguing to see if he wants to instill that same practice that we're doing on the state level to make sure that that's happening on the local level as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Showalter, I want to go back to your slide on higher education and the reference to the state grant program.
Representative Carlson, can you tell the committee what page number that is?
That's 16.
Thank you.
And it says a state grant program providing access to higher education to low and middle income students is protected from reductions. And where I'm going with that, if you recall, last biennium, and we tried to work on that with the negotiations with the governor's office, there was a $30 million shortfall because of increased demand and the increase in the number of students who were eligible. with what you're saying here, is there a projected shortfall for the next biennium? I'm just trying to get a handle on what this language means, if we're covering that increased demand or not, or if the appropriation is just going forward without a cut, I guess is the question.
Madam Chair, Representative, the latter, that the funding level is held constant so that basically, you know, there's some parameters that the program can manage. I'm not sure exactly what the specific changes, if any, are necessary to work within that program, but as we both know, the demand for that program has been expanding, and so changes in some of the parameters that were made in the current biennium.
And perhaps, Madam Chair, Mr. Showalter, if you could get me some additional information on what that projection is, then, you know, in terms of whether or not there's a projected shortfall, and if so, how much as a result of that increased demand.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Showalter, welcome on this snowy morning, and thank you for the quick overview. On page 10, you spoke on the pie chart there. I think that's the page where you referenced the cost of government being 16.3% this biennium. And Madam Chair, I have like three quick questions, if I may. The first one is...
Certainly, Representative Beard.
That is the total state, county, local share of government. I think that's how, if I remember right, that's how we
right.
Related to that, the local government aid that we were talking about, I saw, it seems to me, somewhere a presentation what they called shrinkage. The federal dollars we get back that we're so excited about, it seems that when we send them to Washington, the cost of just running Washington shrinks the dollars somewhere around 15-16%, I think. How much does a local government aid shrink when we take it from the taxpayers, run it through St. Paul, and hand it back to the counties and cities? Is there a number? Has any research been done on that, or is that something we might have to look into someday?
Commissioner Showalter.
And Madam Chair, Representative, interesting question. I have no idea. I've not seen that. I certainly we've talked a little bit about the impact of how reductions in state aids can impact the property tax. I'm not sure how you would look at county contributions to St. Paul in a state government. I'm not sure how you would do that.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I think it goes back to the people who actually originate the money in the first place, the taxpayers. And, of course, we extract it from them through sales tax, corporate taxes, and income taxes, and then we hand it back to the counties, cities, and so on, and call it aid and pat ourselves in the back because we're being so helpful. But, by the way, and we may not have that number, and then maybe it's a question just for future consideration, that knowing about how much money shrinks when we take it from the taxpayers and then give it back to their local taxing units, our government units, might be a useful number for it to have, because it may help us just leave money into taxpayers' pockets in the first place and let the counties tax for it. They might be able to do a more efficient job, I would think. But this is just an assumption. Mm-hmm. It's one of those common sense things, I guess, I kind of think about now and then. But related to that is the 6.5% temporary sales tax we levied almost 20 years ago on local units of government to bring it here, shrink it a little bit, and then hand it back to them. My last question has to do with the number of filers. On page 23, we talk about only 5% of the people are going to be nicked with the tax increase. But as I'm thinking about this, I'm aware that at the federal level, less than or more than 40% of the filers in this country do not pay any income tax. To be clear, I'm talking about the income tax now. Do we know what that number is in Minnesota? How many of our filers do not pay any state income tax, let alone the top 5% we're going to nick here?
Commissioner Showalter, or do you want to...
I'm hoping
you have
to phone
friend
a friend.
To phone.
Madam
phone
Chair, I'm sure somebody does know that number.
Good.
I know that I don't. If nobody steps up, I will make sure we get that figure for you and talk for just 1 second. I want to just go back to the federal analogy on shrinkage, because you know you're absolutely right that the state gets 85%, something like that, back in the federal dollars that it contributes to the tax system. That is not necessarily because of it, that's really a measure of Minnesota paying more of the overall federal budget than other states that have lower incomes. And so the analogy of counties, you have to really carry it out at a county level, say that some counties have shrinkage because they have paid disproportionately more in statewide taxes. As a state, I'm not sure how you would approach that, because it should be 100%. unless you're really after the operating administrative costs and that's what you're capturing as shrinkage, that's certainly not the impact on the federal analogy. The 15% reduction in what Minnesota gets back isn't federal overhead. It's just that we're a wealthier state, and states like Arkansas and Alabama or New Mexico aren't contributing nearly as much as we do, and they have federal bases and other things like that. They get more dollars than we do.
Representative Beard.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point too much, but I wasn't thinking about the fighting for our fair share, because you know how fair share in politicians get. I would just think about the total overhead of supporting Washington. And to be fair, members, the federal government does have very legitimate things it's required to do, like defend the shores, for instance. We've got to do those things, run our international treaties and so on. There are things we expect government to do, and that's, I think, we all agree on. But just the overhead of taking money to Washington then reallocating it, there is a shrinkage factor to run the overhead that probably is outside of things like national defense and so on and so forth. And I'm wondering about that in St. Paul, too, just as the county I'm in gets very little back from the state, and we're just productive and efficient people. We're pretty proud of that. But still, when I look at the amount of dollars that comes through here that goes back out to other areas of the state, I wonder how much of it actually is spent running the heat and lights and parking stalls and the secretaries and so on around this place. And it's just a question I'm interested in. And as for the other one, I realize, Mr. Showalter, we're early in the game. This will be the ninth time I've sat through these presentations now. And the governor is always fair game because you have to come out of the chute first. That's the way it's wired around here. Good luck with that. Thank you for doing it. About March 3rd, I guess, we get the real numbers and we get to do it again. But when we come up to maybe the second time around in March, we'll know that about 130 to 150,000 filers are in our sites now for maybe some revenue enhancements, I think we call it. I'd be interested to know how many don't pay any income tax to the state, and we're accommodating them as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, on page 4 of your presentation, there's a line item here of $877 million in the increased resources, which is called the health care surcharges. Can you explain who pays those surcharges?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I will give you the initial description. If you want more level, we have somebody from Human Services who can certainly help out further. Medicaid surcharges, we have a number of them in current law. Basically, they are being paid by health care providers, whether they managed care organizations, nursing homes, or hospitals. And so there's three major areas in which they have literally separate surcharge structures, separate upper payment limits, in which these surcharges and other charges are managed within. Each of those are managed separately. Each of them are different rates, and that adds up to the $877 million gross revenues. There's also increases in payments that show up on the expenditure side, so that the net figure is about $265 million less than what you see here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I suppose it's safe to assume that those surcharges are going to be passed on to the consumer at some point along the system. Commissioner, how much revenue is the governor looking at raising through corporations, either closing loopholes or increasing corporate income tax, et cetera?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, that figure, and I want to make sure I get it right, was on one of the slides. I think it was about 4. Yep. I hear motion. Okay. Madam Chair, $393 million.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And I know a lot has been said of the tax incident study. The reason we need to kick the rear ends of the top 5% and this whole fair share. But I think the tax incident study also talked about the taxes on corporations as being incredibly regressive, being passed on to the workers through wage adjustments, being passed on to consumers through purchases. Commissioner, I want to direct your attention to slide 23, the very last slide. And Commissioner, I would ask that the next time you give this presentation, you look at that slide and be a little more intellectually honest, because a pie graph that says 95% of the people will see no tax increase. We're not talking income. You're blunt in saying no tax increase. I think we've just talked through that that's not quite right, is it, Commissioner?
Madam Chair.
Representative Showalter.
Representative, true. This is, and the talking points around this are all related to the income tax on households. Corporate tax, other taxes have some incidence on other households. So the representative is quite right, and certainly will clarify that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Biska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, one final question, and it's on page 11. Your slide, the local AIDS credits property tax relief, we're not going to see any reduction there. And your bold statement at the top of the page says protect Minnesotans from property tax increases. Commissioner, is the governor going to be advocating policies which would ensure the truth of that statement?
Representative Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative. The governor is advocating budget changes that underscore that statement. That he's not trying to make budget changes that would exacerbate any of the pressures on local units of government. There are some impacts, obviously, overall in the state government, but in terms of local aids and credits recommendations, he's basically trying to not impact counties and cities by cutting LGA and county program aids. He's not tying the hands of those local officials. And so there is not a proposal on the table at this moment for some kind of levy freeze or something like that. That is not part of the language that you should expect for the governor's budget recommendations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And members, I have Representative Hornstein, then Downey, Kiffmeyer, Abler, Anderson, Eakin, Westrom, and Greiling. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Showalter, thanks for coming. I was pleased that you do have the closing corporate loopholes part of the budget, and it says and other loopholes, which I think relate to folks that go down to Florida and then extend their residency there in order to avoid paying tax in Minnesota. Do you know approximately how much money we're losing because of that practice?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not a big dollar amount. I think it was like $15 million thereabouts, and it is one of those other loopholes. The governor, as much as anything, wanted to include it because it was a statement. He knew of people who used that loophole and felt it was just patently unfair. And while he thinks that it's probably worth much, much more than we're estimating, we worked with the Department of Revenue. They did what they could to estimate the impact of that. And so I think we've got a relatively conservative number in there as to what would happen.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, if you, I think, add that then to sort of the other scofflaws, if you will. I think that then becomes a much larger figure, maybe even into the triple digits of millions. The people that are just not filing year after year, we're just not getting that revenue. Do you have a sense if we included that amount? And I think there have been different proposals over the years about how to actually get that amount of money. We know we're not going to get all of it, but is there going to be some additional enforcement mechanisms, I think, that this administration might pursue to get at that revenue?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, our representative, it is an important thing to make sure that everyone's paying their fair share, and certainly the governor's budget recommendation does include a small compliance initiative. The notion, however, that Minnesota's it will always have some people who are just trying to be outside the boundaries. We've got a pretty large compliance effort at the Department of Revenue right now. We're one of the leaders in that area nationwide, and so while there are some things I think on the margin that we're trying to get done in this budget recommendation, it's probably not without policy changes like the snowbird loophole. Without policy changes, I'm not sure that it's going to amount to a very large dollar figure.
And Commissioner,
thank
just
you, Madam Chair.
To this point, is a summer cabin an abode?
Madam Chair, I need a lawyer for that one.
Well, Commissioner, as I read the document on that particular tax increase, I envision people that have summer cabins that reside out of state if they come here for 2 months in the summer and buy groceries here and pay our gas tax, pay seasonal property tax. They're contributing mightily to our coffers already, and I'm just wondering if they're going to be subject to this snowbird tax as well and what effects it might have on tourism in the state.
Madam Chair, the answer is yes. A cabin is an abode, so it would have an impact. So somebody was here for 4 months in a summer cabin, they could be impacted by the snowbird proposal.
I'll have to let my cousins know about that. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Just letting Mr. Showalter.
I'm getting more answers. Should I try to catch up to answers yet unanswered, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
All right. To Representative Beard's question, about 38% of Minnesota tax units, which I believe would be a euphemism for households, did not pay income tax, and about 26% of non-dependent adults. So I think that should address that question.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Showalter, I just want to make sure I'm understanding the interactions between our beginning balance and our reserves and our ending balance on page 3. And to make sure I'm understanding, so if we go down to the reserves line, we'll have $136 million less in reserves at the end of this two-year biennium than we have today. And so therefore that that lack of reserves or that reduction in reserves is being consumed somewhere. And similarly, if we look at the governor's budget column for fiscal year 2012 and 13, we have a beginning balance of $660 million and then an ending balance of $3 million. So somewhere $557 million is being consumed just by virtue of the fact that we had a beginning balance that's much higher than our ending balance. And Madam Chair, if I could just confirm that I'm stating that correctly.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. That's right.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, if I could continue. So that's about $691 million, if I do my math right, between the reserves and the beginning balance. Are those overlapping somehow? Are the reserves a component of our beginning balance?
Yes.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly it. I realize I say absolutely you're right. The $3 million, you still have $139 million in reserves, so that's sort of part of that shift. Not shift, but it's sort of that difference between those two numbers of the beginning balance of $674 million. Subtract off the reserves, so you have consume about $139 there. You have about $3 on the ending balance. The remainder is used as resources in the biennial budget recommendations.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to understand the spreadsheet here on page 3 and then also on page 6, so the 37090 as expenditures doesn't actually reflect the consumption of our reserves and our beginning balance. Is that correct? So there's another. It's all baked in there somehow.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's all baked in. So the expenditure is really showing the uses, the sources of funds are both some of that beginning balance and the revenues that are anticipated during the course of the biennium. Those support those expenditures. What's left at the end, it becomes the cash flow account and the remaining balance.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I'm clear, but I'll talk to you offline just to make sure I understand that.
Sure.
And then if I could, on page 8 as well, you talk about the structural balance, and I know I actually proposed paying back half of the K-12 shift in the next biennium and was roundly chastised by education advocates for not structurally balancing our budget and not honoring our commitment in K-12. But just to confirm, so if we were to leave the K-12 shift kind of fully in the 14 and 15 biennium, we'd be adding another $1.3 billion to the structural deficit. So really this number of $1.1 billion for the 14-15 biennium, if we were kind of true to the way we're counting the budget deficit today with the full shift payback in this biennium, we'd really be more at a $2.4 billion structural deficit, right? We're doing a shift to kind of get out of $1.1 billion of the structural deficit.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's right. You know, obviously about 1.4, that would be a one-time event in that biennium, but yeah, the comparison of revenues and expenditures for that biennium would be worse by about that amount.
And Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final follow-on then. So we got about a $2.5 billion structural deficit in 14 and 15. Has the governor thought about how he would bridge that? I mean, we're talking about a temporary surcharge on the top income earners. Even if we do that, we're still another, one point something or other billion short in the next biennium. So it seems to me we haven't really created structural balance here. We've kind of perpetuated the deficit scenario of at least $2 billion if we really looked at it honestly from a structural standpoint. Has he thought about what he would do in the next biennium to bridge that gap?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, in terms of the talking about the structural deficit honestly being $2 billion, I don't think that's quite right. I think the question is how are we going to end up repaying that significant aid payment shift as well as the property tax recognition shift. You know, those are ironically not so much structural issues as very large one-time issues. They're large one-time resources that are used in the current biennium, and how are we going to get those paid back? So in his recommendations, he starts to feather them in so that they aren't substantially impacting one biennium's numbers in the way that you're describing, so that a $1.1 billion deficit becomes a structural balance of imbalance of $2.5 billion. I just want to be clear about what is sort of how we use it depicts sort of the next biennium, because the recommendations here to your question about $1.1 billion, it is not structurally balanced. That's correct. It is substantially closer, and the out years tend to be the most volatile figures. It really relies on changes in the economy, assumptions and spending patterns that will bounce around roughly six or more times before we finally lock in a budget for those years. So I'm not comfortable. I'm not going to say as your Commissioner of Management Budget I like to have a deficit in the out years. But given that we're coming out of a recession, given that we've got a $6 billion or more deficit right now, I think that's a substantial movement in the correct direction. And that's really, I think, the first step.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Showalter. Good to see you this morning, making it through that snow. Appreciate that effort. In regards to page 11, again, on the property taxes, mm-hmm. I see here the very significant statement about no reductions, but I see a lot of other kinds of words here that says avoid, ensures that the decision to raise property taxes will be local, reduces pressure to increase property, but it isn't quite as definitive that there will be no property tax increases. But my question is, though, is there some sort of agreement on the basis of the League of Minnesota Cities or Greater Minnesota or anybody else or the counties or anything like that that says if you have no reductions, we will not raise property taxes? Is there any sort of agreement like that, verbal or otherwise?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I two things. No, there's no agreement between the administration and local units of government on a overarching policy for all units of government. As the words here suggest, it's trying to ensure that raising property taxes will truly be local decisions, that the state itself will not be creating issues for those local units of government. There's not a ironclad promise that local units of government, what they're going to do, though that's the responsibility of those local units of government.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, well, that's interesting then, because there's usually always been a connection that if we reduce local government aid, then property taxes will go up. And implied in that is that, well, if we raise local government aid or we keep it the same, you would think then that would mean property taxes would either go down or stay the same. So I just know that later on, if they do make a local decision to raise property taxes, and if this no reduction did go through, I guarantee you the statement would be made that somehow it is the state's fault. And so I just find it interesting here that it's, you know, it's put in this way, but there's all kinds of squish when it comes to the fact that local governments may still raise property taxes. That's correct, right? They still may do that.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, local units of government still have the obligation to balance their budgets and make those levy decisions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that answers my question.
Thank you. Representative Abler, then Anderson, Eakin, Westrom, Greiling, Davids, and Kahn. Representative Abler.
It's a popular topic, Madam Chair. I just have a comment and then a question. The reps and business ask about surcharges and so on, and the heart of those is existing state policy where we capture every federal dollar we can. Lately, I think that's caused somewhat put us at risk. I think the thought is that those monies fall from the sky, much like the foot of snow did, and we think it's endless here, and the thinking is that the federal money is endless. We justify it, and I think we get 71% of our dollars back. It's something in that range, as I recollect, but never mind what number it is. It's not free. It comes from our neighbors and from people and, you know, everywhere. And in a time, my thinking, just for the sake of the chair and the committee here, is that if we intend to build our budget on more of that when the federal people are $1.6 trillion or so in deficit this year, and every 41 cents of every dollar lately is borrowed from or made up in little paper chits to buy bonds for the Federal Reserve, that's a risky proposition. Especially given how it's going out there, Madam Chair, if you've been reading the paper, it's not going smoothly in terms of that money supply continuing. So, I mean, it's kind of cool to get money that pops in, but I think to build a budget on it is somewhat hopeful. And that'll come up more as we discuss my budget, and I don't know what we'll be relying on that or not, but I just think it's scary to do that. About the reps and Downey touched on my question about the reserves, and I see you're reducing them to spend on whatever worthy projects we bought. There's been some concern on the cash flow and so on. And I know you use these for cash flow. Is this going to be enough now? We don't have to borrow from schools anymore, and this will be sufficient so we can make all our obligations. And is that the conclusion that we can draw from that new number, Mr. Showalter?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I would not suggest that our cash flow issues are resolved. In the short term, what you see here is really a recognition that current year revenues are substantially above our expectations on a cash basis. And so, you know, we're doing better this month than we thought 5 months ago. And so, ultimately, we are still going to have cash issues as we go into the next biennium, depending on what budget solution is recognized. And in the short term, the governor also had to put out a budget now with the expectation that this forecast will likely be at least a little bit better. So even at the press conference, he said, you know, one of the first things I would do if the forecast gets $130 million better, you know, I'll restore the cash flow account. I think it's an important element to our overall financial strategy. It adds another risk, as you were talking about before, in a management of not having disruption of state services. And so ultimately, you know, we need at least, the level that we have currently, probably getting back up to the $350 million. And a lot of careful management on an ongoing basis. So I do not want to suggest that the cash flow issues are all done. It's going to be something that we will talk about, I think, throughout the rest of the session, depending on what kind of solutions we use to balance the budget and the timing of the impact of those options.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
That's not the answer I expected, and I thought I knew what you were going to say. This will be sufficient, and I wasn't trying to set you up. I'm just kind of surprised. We've sat through our human service hearings, and I have consciously not been very aggressive on the department. They didn't have much time, and some of the choices they chose, I hope we don't have to pick. And if that's our conclusions, I've we're going to have some challenges in that arena. But I was hoping in the global picture of the money, given that there's some $4 billion of new revenues that many of us think aren't even attainable in reality, that certainly this part would be a number. And so I'll leave it at that. There were three editorials on Sunday's paper. One said great thing, one said like, yeah, really, and then one said doomed. And that was the middle position. And so we're going to have to really get real about this stuff. And I'd like you, Mr. Showalter, and welcome to your new job. And it's hope you. But I don't think it's sensible to bring a budget to us that has a cash reserve number that's not a real one, based on getting the most high revenues anybody's ever going to see. At least you could have the number you want. And so I'm going to stop, so I don't want to embarrass you, but I would like to know at some point what number is the right number we should have, and I'll leave it at that. So thank you.
Well, and Commissioner, in simple terms, does the governor's proposed budget improve the cash flow situation?
Madam Chair, I can't answer that yet, and that's the trick to this question, because the cash flow projections are done on a daily basis, really looking on the interaction of revenues and spending on a daily estimate. We have people starting down that path, but it usually takes several weeks in order to figure that out. It's tuning the estimates to a monthly estimate, a daily estimate of all of the things that are before us. So I'm going to have to defer that question, or answering that question at least, until I get concrete information on how the income tax changes play out on an annual basis. I'm not sure.
So, just for clarification purposes, do you envision, even after you raise $4 billion in new revenue, you're still going to have to do all of these tricks with temporary fund transfers back and forth from different reserves? And I mean, do you view that as a continuing process under this administration, even given the large tax increases included in its budget?
Madam Chair, I think the cash management issue is not so much related to whether it's a tax increase or a spending reduction. It's related to the reserve levels and the time and the certainty of how those actions take effect. So it's not a tax increase or a spending cut question. It's really, do we have our budget reserve replenished? Do we have, getting up to, more like a $600 million to $1 billion level of reserves. The governor and his recommendations will have some language, at least changing 16A, so that we can get the budget reserve up to a larger balance, because the economists have been talking about it for a while. The state budget trends work group talked about it for a while, that we're relatively lightly reserved. And that leads us to some of the shifts and other things like that we've all had to use in order to get through tough economic times. Cash flow closely linked to level reserves. Ultimately, we need to get those reserves back up and increase them as the economy gets better.
Well, given your knowledge of the budget, which is vast, and your experience in managing the cash flow over the last couple of years, and what you know about the governor's proposed budget at this time, what do you think is the likelihood of having to resort to the short-term borrowing that we have had in place as an option but haven't had to use yet?
Madam Chair, right now anything I say is really, really speculative.
What?
Because cash flow doesn't follow a logic that you might think sometimes. My suspicion is that we would continue to have to very closely manage cash for the next several years. And the X factor is whether the economy continues to perform slightly better than forecast, slightly better than the budget is built on, or slightly worse. That the reserve level that we have is too small. And so if we continue to outperform and we balance the budget, we'll be at least in a zone of trying to manage it. And then it'll get down to the detailed estimates and the timing of payments. If, in fact, the revenues don't come in the pace that one is expecting, whether they are augmented with tax increases or whether they are cut by tax decreases, we don't have much of the reserves to handle cash.
All right. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Showalter. I was listening to Representative Beard talk about the shrinkage of the LGA, and that might be true for his area, but in my area it's been an expansion because we've gotten back more from the state than we put in. I don't know what the average is, and that would be helpful. I guess that was one of the questions that I had, was if there's any kind of information that you could provide as far as what regions of the state pay in and which ones are recipient areas of the state, for instance, and what the averages might be. But I think it's important to point out that the reason that was done, that we have the statewide system set up, is to ensure that the tax burden doesn't fall too heavily on one particular area of the state. And in my area, we do pay among the highest tax rates in the state. And that's the reason that we get back more from the state, is to try to help even out that tax burden. And again, that's why it was set up. And I'm glad to see that you're addressing, the administration is addressing that tax burden issue and trying to even out that tax burden more fairly. And I would think it would also be helpful if we could get information as far as who's paying the highest tax burdens regionally. The information that we've gotten has been helpful as far as income levels and who's paying the highest tax burden. And as the income levels go down, the tax burden has been going up. But I think it would also be helpful if we'd find out, for instance, what the tax burdens are in the rural areas of the state as opposed to the suburban areas or the exurban areas or the urban areas. So, and I don't know if you have any of that information that you can provide here, or if that would be information that you could access for us.
Yes.
And then I have one more question.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that information, but my suspicion is that the Department of Revenue does have runs or information that might be able to address some of those. I'd be happy to put them in contact with you.
Okay, thank you. And then just one more question. And the other question, Commissioner Showalter, is as far as the fourth tier tax increase, now some of that can be written off on the federal taxes, is that correct?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And about how much do they get back from federal taxes? Because it seems to me that that's bringing more federal money back into the state and would help address maybe the issue of bringing more of that federal tax dollar back to Minnesota. And I was just wondering what percentage of what that income tax increase that will come back to Minnesota by writing it off the federal taxes.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends, obviously, on the income of the individual household as to how much, what their marginal federal tax rate is going to be. I'm not sure if you've got in the handouts one of the additional pieces put together. It's just slightly larger than the slide that you've got in your handouts, but it really takes a look at the total state tax change as well as the tax change after federal deductions. So I'll give you an example of a married joint filer with two children, adjusted gross income of $500,000, home value of $1.5 million. The state tax change would be $9,374. The change in total tax after federal deductions would be $6,093. So the difference between those two figures is the state deductibility, or the federal deductibility of state income and property taxes on their overall net income tax burden.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Westrum.
Madam Chair, you indulge me for about three questions. Commissioner, you, in your presentation, you talked about the February forecast coming out in a week, and education may get adjusted. What did you mean by that? And do you anticipate the forecast to get better?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, education, human services are two of the areas that you get better data on, the number of pupils for education, as an example, or the number of kids with free and reduced lunch accounts. So those numbers will almost certainly be updated by the Department of Education up or down. I don't have any information as to which way at this moment, but it's just sort of the normal practice that, you know, that's one of the areas that will be adjusted. Overall, you know, I'm happy that on a monthly basis we continue to track, if not outperform, the November forecast estimates. The question, I think, overall is one that each monthly number can lead to real bad conclusions if you take it too seriously. And so that's what Tom Stinson and the economists are trying to figure out right now. But all in all, I think most of the information, most of the GDP changes, most of the net revenue that we've gotten on a monthly basis are all at least up to forecast, if not a little bit better.
Okay. Can you explain a little more, Madam Chair, Commissioner, this quote-unquote snowbird loophole? Could you explain that to myself and the public and other members here that aren't up to speed with what we're calling a loophole?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to try. It's basically income taxes are paid by residents of the state. A residence is determined by living in that state for at least 6 months. So if you are out of the state for one day less than 6 months, you would be probably living someplace else, and so that's your place of residence. If you happen to be living in Florida as your for 6 months and a day and come back to Minnesota for the remainder of the year, you wouldn't be paying income taxes here. You'd be paying income taxes in Florida, but they have no income taxes, so that works out for you. The governor's proposal is to say, well, if you're coming back to Minnesota for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, and 29 days, some pro rata portion after you've paid income taxes in the state of your residence will be due to Minnesota. Tax-wise, tax compliance-wise, it's going to be tricky. But I think the important message that the governor is trying to send is that everyone needs to pay their fair share, and if you're really trying to avoid Minnesota income taxes, we should make sure that there's at least some opportunity to collect some share of that revenue from Minnesota.
So, Mr.
Westrum.
Mr. Schultz-Walter, two questions on that. What are other states doing this, and what if they're going there to avoid the weather and not taxes?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't imagine trying to avoid the weather. It's delightful. Certainly, that is a fair issue. And I want to emphasize that it's not necessarily for nefarious reasons that people might be living outside of Minnesota for 6 months out of the year. It could be just that. And they would be paying exactly the taxes that they're supposed to be paying right now. The governor is just asking that if that's the case, you know, and they're really outside the state for a little bit more than a year, but they're still here for almost a year, that at least some of the overall tax burden might be paid by those households.
Well, Commissioner,
are other states?
If I can just for a second, the standard that he's using, though, is 60 days. So, I mean, they could be out of the state for 10 months of the year and still be subject to this. I mean, I look at people that spend their summers in Minnesota at family cabins that have been in the family for decades, and given just the way our society is moving around the country, they establish strong traditions of spending their summers in Minnesota in whole or part. And so, I mean, I don't think you're using this 6 months figure, but I think you got to be honest here and say, I believe it's 61 days.
Madam Chair, as a minimum threshold, I believe that's correct. What is also true, though, is that if they're living in a state with income tax, they're going to get a credit for all of the taxes that they've paid in that state. And then once you prorate it so that if they're here for only a month, there's not likely to be any impact on that household whatsoever. It's more the situation where they may be in a state that has no income taxes or that they are here for substantial parts of the year, where you're actually going to see an impact. That's part of the reason why the fiscal impact of this provision is relatively low.
Well, I think that if you talk to some of these people that come here, they might argue with the impacts that they pay on seasonal property tax rates, what they contribute to the school systems, and aren't able to access even the most minor services, can't get a library card because they don't have a permanent address in the community where their cabin is. So their load on services, if you will, is probably pretty low, in large part because we don't even allow them to access the services due to their lack of residency. So this is one that just really seems kind of crazy to me. But I'm sorry, Representative Westrom, I interrupted.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I guess I need to drill a little more on this before I get to my last question. Commissioner, my district is fairly close to the North and South Dakota borders. They have tax rates that are much more favorable to us. Let me just assure you, when you're that close to the border and the tax rate is that far out of compliance, there is pressure. Human ingenuity and pressure in everybody's finances to find the way to save dollars or pay the least amount in taxes or have the most left in their pocket for their own evening suppers or kids' coats or medicine. And so I just think we need to be careful about where we're going with this, because about 10 years ago, a representative leader knows this well. We actually had to put a task force in place to drive around the borders and find all the citizens that are licensing in South Dakota or Wisconsin or North Dakota, because our tax on vehicles was so out of whack with the neighboring states that you could go up and down the borders within 20-30 miles. We sent a fraud unit together to try to track this down. It helped a ton when Governor Ventura pushed for the lowering of the license tab fees. But to my question about North and South Dakota, their weather usually comes here after they get it. My community has an RV park that our community owns, but a lot of North and South Dakotans come and live there in the summer. Will they also be subject to this snowbird tax?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I will, in a specific example, I'd rather have the Department of Revenue try to walk through the instance of which state they're coming from, their household income, what income taxes they pay. I think the bottom line here is that on the snowbird, you know, it's an attempt to close a loophole. I understand that it's a difficult one to get at, because you know, we talked about a number of instances where the language will try to be crafted so it doesn't have some unintended consequences. But you know, ultimately, if somebody's coming to the state for a substantial portion of the year, and they will get a credit for any income tax payments that they've made in their state of residence, and then to the extent that there's still an applicable income tax here, that would be impacted. We can certainly talk about that more, and I'd be happy to get the Department of Revenue to walk through some more specifics.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, on that note, on that issue, and I'll move to my last question. Then, I think you're demonstrating just to us how tremendously difficult this would be, and the sign or the signal we would send to people that come in and help our tourism economy thrive would be negative at best. On one hand, we say we want tourism, and the next hand, we say, "But don't stay here very long, or we're gonna get you even more, because then we're gonna treat you like a resident." Moving on, then to this mode and mood of closing loopholes. This topic came up a couple times at some meetings I was at this weekend. In the legal world, you've got clients that have wealth, and sometimes they look for other states to park that wealth because the state they're in isn't so good. Would we be closing loopholes on clients of lawyers or residents in Minnesota that, for whatever reason, they or their family have set up trusts or other entities outside of our state to avoid our tax structure because it's more favorable in another state?
Uh,
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe there is something along that line, and I know it was related to trusts and estates and creating a temporary
estate.
But that's about all the words I can utter on that. Madam Chair, I Representative, I'd be happy to either Mike will try to figure out the specifics in a minute, or I can follow up. But I know there was one provision along the lines that you're describing.
Okay, if you could let us know, that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think that, in my opinion, I just want to go on record as saying that I like the governor's budget. We can always pick at the details, the $15 million snowbird. You know, it sounds like the majority party may want to kick that one out. It's $15 million. But this is a big budget. That's, you know, that's a small ticket item. And generally speaking, right now with our system, we have the poor paying 20% in state and local taxes, the middle class 12, and the upper classes 9. And so I just think that that's the big picture. That's something that we all should be lamenting in this state and not worrying so much about the $15 million for those who take advantage of the snowbird loophole or those who might be coming in here from other states. We should be thinking about our own taxpayers and the very unfair tax system that we have right now. And that's what I'm very delighted that this budget addresses. Of course, as a person who focuses here on education, I'm happy that the governor increased that a little bit. I would agree with Representative Downey. If I'd had my perfect budget, I would have had a blink on tax on instead of just for the 3 years for the people who earn $500,000, I would have liked to have seen us increase that a little bit more for 1 year just to get rid of the borrowing from schools with the late payments, and that's just a one-time cost. But to at least address it in the next biennium and have a plan where it's paid back 10% a year or more if our revenue allows, I think is a really solid plan. And I'm glad we have a need-based government system here in Minnesota. The property taxes and the I could argue both sides of the local government aid, because my cities, two of my three don't get it, one really needs it and does. And then, of course, I'm in Ramsey County, which is a very needy county when it comes to local government aid. So I have to come out on the side of supporting need-based, and I always look to Representative Lencheski and Lanning to make sure it's a fair need-based system. But generally speaking, I just want to register my extreme approval of the plan, and I hope we do have a good forecast on my birthday, February 28th, so that we don't have to cut it quite so close to the edge in terms of the reserves. And I'm very pleased with that answer also from Mr. Showalter, that if there is a revenue a forecast that's rosy, that the money would go into the reserve. I think that's fiscally responsible. And to have to continue borrowing from the schools like Governor Pawlenty did for the first time in history for the last 2 years, I'm hoping we actually don't do that. But I don't really have a question, Madam Chair, but I just, with listening here to all the what I would call nitpicking of some of the small details, I had to register my just my general happiness with the budget, including the revenue, on a progressive basis. And I'm very worried, though, about an all-cuts budget when we do get around to that discussion, because like some of the Republicans that looked at Governor Dayton's budget, I also was stunned at the level of cuts in this budget in health and human services to things like nursing homes and 7,200 people not qualifying anymore for Minnesota care. So, and that's with all this new revenue. So I'm very worried about protecting education and having to see deeper cuts in things like health and human services or having property taxes go up if we don't keep the local government aid. I have a lot of senior citizens in my district, and they're very, very hurt the most by the property taxes when they keep going up. And you know, you hear the phrase, it gets to be kind of a trite phrase, being taxed out of their home, but I hear that in my district with people who live in a middle class suburbs, and then when the property taxes keep going up to make up for what we're not doing with the schools and the counties and the cities, that really is such an unfair tax for people like seniors. And so I think that would be a much worse thing to do to them even than the cuts in nursing homes if we had to balance out those kind of devil's choices. So thank you for indulging my comments.
Well, thank you, Representative Greiling, and I'm sure the executive branch will be looking for some bill authors here pretty soon, so I wouldn't be surprised if you see them come knocking. Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, first of all, I apologize for being late. I think I'm the only one who had a 150-foot driveway, a little car, and a grumpy husband. So,
I have just as long of a driveway, but I have a big SUV, and I have no clue where my husband was. I took care of it myself, so.
Anyway. And a Prius, Madam Chair.
Yes, it's I finally made it. But anyway, the first of all, Representative Westrum asked a question or started to ask a question, and I don't think it got answered. And that's, what's the picture across the country with the snowbird-like tax? How do other states treat partial residents across the country?
Commissioner Showalter.
And if you don't have that answer now, it's something I guess both of us, it's a Westrum Con question, it's got to be right.
Commissioner.
Both of us would like to know that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know. I'm not sure that other states have this provision, so would be happy to confirm with the Department of Revenue and get back to the Westrum Con.
And then the other... Then the other issue, and I apologize if this has been asked before, and of course I hate to use Wisconsin as an example for anything, but one of the things that they are looking to do, and that they say they need to have it settled by Friday to do it, is refinancing their debt. Have we done the limits of refinancing our debt, or is there any possibility of refinancing, of getting something from refinancing some of our debt?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, sometimes Wisconsin may use refinancing as a euphemism for other things. I'm not entirely sure what they're talking about. In terms of what we would normally talk about, refinancing our debt, yes. In the last 6 months, the state refunded roughly $800-900 million of general fund obligation, GO debt, at a lower rate. Got substantial savings, and that showed up in the November forecast. At this point, we're not anticipating much, if any, additional refunding, just because we've pretty much refunded almost all of the issues that are eligible for refunding at this point in time. You know, the impact is always to sort of lower the interest rate profile for our debt. While I have a chance, I also want to just respond to Representative Westrum's question about changes in loopholes. There is a provision, and it's titled estate tax, that's the program area, and the item is called the pass-through entity, friends, non-residents. And it really is looking at that passing of personal property located in Minnesota and held by a non-resident, and basically putting it through a pass-through entity like a partnership, an S-corp, or a limited liability company or trust, and closing that loophole. There have been some instances where we're starting to see that activity, and the Department of Revenue is trying to close that off before it becomes a much bigger issue.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Representative Kahn, we have to be nice to Wisconsin until they pay us back the money. So, Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know you're trying to adjourn, so you know, maybe you could answer this next time, and it's really a question for you, Madam Chair, just kind of listening to everybody, in particular the line of questioning on the cash flow and the budget reserve, and a number of people were talking about that. And I just will recall for the committee that Representative Carlson and I carried for Governor Pawlenty significant changes to assist him to not have to deal with short-term borrowing, and we did everything we could in the majority to assist Governor Pawlenty, and we have a whole bunch of new laws. And I think listening to Commissioner Showalter, we're not, you know, I think his answer is the right one. Nobody really knows in all the pieces we moved around for the previous governor how that'll all play out. Now, I think some of those requests by Governor Plenty that Representative Carlson and I carried were actually really good policy and should have been done a long time ago to allow more flexibility to people, to our state employees, to move things around to not have to do short-term borrowing. I think others were questionable, and we carried them because Governor Plenty did not want to short-term borrow, and while we could have done a gotcha, I think we thought it was best for Minnesotans to not have to go to that level and to not potentially harm our debt rating further. So I think that kind of whole issue remains to be seen, and I hope, Chair Holberg, that you will work diligently with the new administration to do everything you can to protect residents as far as they look to possibly have to, you know, see things sour on them. But I guess my question is on, you know, the whole big, you know, you're the finance chair, you're the Ways and Means chair, so the big deal, the whole big budget here now, there's all these moving parts, and Dayton's is out, yours is coming next. And, you know, I have to say, you know, you maybe can't answer this for your caucus, for Speaker Zellers, but repeatedly I've heard, you know, from candidate Emmer down to everybody who ran for the House, the same thing. We don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. Oh, and so that means, you know, of course there won't be any revenue in your budget. And, you know, I have a couple of concerns, is that there's a lot of bills out there with all kinds of revenue, like fees and surcharges and fire safety accounts, and they're floating through the system. I've asked Chair Davids, as the revenue chair, to herd them back to his committee, and he's committed to do that. We've been very diligent when we were in the majority to make sure every dollar licensing, you know, fishing license fee got to taxes, and we have a rule on that, that a tax is a fee. And so I understand that the big policy principle here in the new majority is we don't need any more revenue. But my question to you directly is, the forecast has a revenue number, and we've heard people say this over and over, you know, there was 30, you're already going to get 32.4, that's an automatic 5-7% in revenue, we don't need any more, when you're out of money, stop spending. Okay, so the current projection is 32.4. If the next forecast is 33 or 33.4, will you ensure your caucus and the speaker that you're going to only spend 32.4? Because if there's not a revenue problem, if more comes in, is the intention that the new majority will sort of, you know, change focus here and say, well, actually, we are going to spend more than 32.4? Can you just comment on where you might be in the process? I know you're probably working on targets, but, you know, just for all of us to kind of understand that big picture question on the overall budget number. Thank you.
Well, and thank you for the question. I can't give you a solid answer. Generally, as probably happened in your caucus, we have to work through a leadership model and an executive board, and we have a whole range of members of our caucus that may have said those things on the campaign trail or may have not. I'd be surprised if every single one of them, knowing some of them, said that. So I'd be interested if you have a spreadsheet and dates and quotes or whatever. But, I mean, I think time will tell. I don't know if the commissioner would like to make a bet as far as if and how much additional revenue will be in the February forecast. Some of us have been doing that. You know, just in discussion purposes, I don't think it's going to be a lot, and whether or not there'll be a decision to use that or not, I really can't at this time say. But we will work pretty rapidly once we do have the February forecast, and depending on, the commissioner talked earlier about his plan that they would have adjustments back out to us fairly rapidly. We're hoping in a number of days. Because then we want to get the targets, as you've seen. The deadlines are pretty aggressive relative to finance bills, and that all bills have to be out of finance committees and on their way to Ways and Means by the 25th of March, which really doesn't give us a lot of time. So it won't be that long, and we'll have the answer to your question.
Thank you.
So, Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Showalter, my question is on page 17, and I'm wondering if anybody up at the governor's office is reading the newspapers lately, because when you're talking about cutting into offender supervision, the Star Trib has had, I think, a couple of articles in just the last couple of weeks where there's been a complete breakdown in offender supervision, and somebody wandering around down at St. Peter, a sex offender that wandered in the community and took off in a cab. Another one recently committed crimes, put a gun to somebody's head while
He was out, and nobody knew where he was, and they talked about a breakdown in supervision. And so streamlined offender supervision, that word streamline always bothers me, and general administrative reductions of 5%. I've wondered why, with all the hoopla statewide in the last month or so about supervision and lack of it, why you would cut into supervision. And also the best way to counter that is for the governor to support my bill where you would double the sentences up to 25 years for first-degree sex offenders, and you don't have to supervise them when they're behind bars. So I was wondering if he would be willing to make a commitment on my bill, and how would you answer the question about the cut into offender supervision?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, I can certainly address the first question. The second question as to supporting a specific bill, I can't address. But the reductions in corrections are very difficult. And it just so you understand the context, this is even starting from a place where about $26 million in corrections base funding was restored as the starting point, and then trying to still get some reductions out of the public safety area. It is the next largest area after education, human services, higher ed, and local aids and credits, and it not got a lot of great options. And so I don't think these are reductions that I would advocate to saying, yep, they're going to improve offender supervision. At the same time, the new commissioner does come from that area. He understands the system very well and is trying to make sure that we're very, very judicious about what we do. The overall impact, we're trying to make sure that we're working with our county partners because, you know, it's a integrated system. It's just a difficult area, and you don't see big reductions here, in part because of the difficulties with just ensuring public safety, ensuring that the system keeps on working, and that they have some option for absorbing some of these impacts.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Commissioner Schroeder, you just let the governor know that we've got a lot of better options headed his way soon.
Very good.
Representative Kahn, last question.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I was going to go in exactly the opposite way as Representative Cornish. First of all, the cost of putting the cost of doubling those sentences, I think, is an awful lot. Is not a cost that's negligible, and that's an awful lot higher than the costs of supervision. One of the things that I'm saying is, can we? And I'm obviously not an expert in this, but some of the people who are experts can look seriously at our corrections system and look at how many people are in prison who really don't pose any danger and what should be done. I'm particularly concerned, of course, about the concept that we're going to get into geriatric home prisons and how many people need to have the kind of intense supervision of a prison when they really belong in some kind of geriatric home. And I don't intend to solve that problem, but I wish the people who know something about it would.
Madam Chair, I think it's actually a savings because the sex offender program costs way more than imprisoning them. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but we're 49th in the nation in incarceration rates. We're doing really good. So,
thank you. Commissioner Schwalder, I just want to talk about one more thing real briefly. And a number of our fiscal chairs sent out letters to your commissioners asking for information. And on Valentine's Day, I got a letter from you that may have been a little less than admiring, let's just say, relative to our requests for information. And in the letters that were sent out to your commissioners, about half of the items, as far as we can find, are not available on the websites. And in cases where information is on the website, we've used those numbers and then been told those are not the correct numbers. So we're a little frustrated at this point. We hear the governor saying that he wants to work with us. He, you know, that his commissioners are available. As far as we've pulled our different fiscal chairs, as far as where they're at with gathering information in preparation for their budget overviews, and we're working on targets as well, and some of this information would be able to inform our budget setting process. And so I'm just curious, setting aside the issue of work product for your budget preparation, which is it? You know, I mean, we were looking forward to working with the agency heads, commissioners, and we're frustrated.
Very good, Madam Chair. We still want to work together, get you the information. As you probably know, the amount of data and the scope of the request was really quite broad, and staff were trying to figure out, well, how do they accommodate that within the context of still trying to get the governor's budget recommendations articulated, finalized into BBS, all of those things. They're now working on the forecast literally this weekend and today. If there are specific things that the fiscal staff of the House can't provide or can't access through BBS and they want our help, absolutely, we will try to facilitate that.
And we appreciate that, and we know, you know, that your budget was due out on the 15th. We understand that, but we're trying to move quite rapidly here as well, and to the degree that we're being shut down by agencies and getting information that's not publicly available but should be available to the public and legislators as well, we would appreciate your cooperation.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you. With that, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.